KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The high in the low 50s.
Drop my microphones and the recorders and all the rest of it, and then over the horizon comes Mr. Grizzly Bear, and I realize I can't stay there to record, so I've got to walk back another difficult mile.
Why should I ask a politician an easy question? I am not his lackey. I'm not his flunky.
This company filed bankruptcy many years ago, went through a long process, and a buyout firm actually came in and bought the company. They lost every penny they put in.
Martin Stewart has been recording wildlife around the world. He's going to talk about what he's encountered and what needs to be done to save some endangered species. Brian Johnson is going to talk about why he is no lackey to politicians, retiring 50-odd years after starting at Como as a newsman. We're going to start, though, with what's happening with Hostess today on Weekday on KUOW. I'm Steve Scher. Hostess has declared it's laying off 18,500 workers, including workers in Seattle and Puget Sound, shutting down operations at 33 bakeries in the U.S. The company has blamed a strike by the Bakers Union. The union points to mismanagement, excessive CEO pay, while workers were taking pay cuts and benefit cuts. It appears the company's famous Twinkies and Wonder Bread brands will live on, but the news sparked panic buying, as you heard. Hostess treats on eBay's where bidding started at $100 for four boxes of chocodiles. David Kaplan is contributing editor to Fortune magazine. He has a 20-year career as a writer and editor at Newsweek, teaches journalism at NYU. David Kaplan, thanks for taking the time.
Good morning.
So you wrote this article, Hostess Goes Bankrupt Again. A little background on what's actually happening here, because, boy, you could read different newspapers and get a whole different sense on who the players are in this and who's to blame for this problem.
Well, there's plenty of blame to go around. I don't really think there's a white hat and a black hat. There are a lot of gray hats. The major players are two big unions, the Bakers Union and the Teamsters Union. Hostess, the company, and in the background are two hedge funds and a private equity firm that help bring the company out of its first bankruptcy several years ago, but loaded up the company with a lot of debt that probably doomed it in retrospect from back then. The company just had no chance to innovate, no chance to modernize, and there were these pension problems that date back decades that were never solved in the first bankruptcy, and that's what Hostess, the company, hoped the unions would go along with. The Teamsters did, and agreed to all kinds of givebacks, but the Bakers Union balked.
When did those first givebacks begin? When were they first requested?
Well, the unions gave stuff back in the first bankruptcy when Hostess came out of that in 2009 and had been in bankruptcy for 5 years. Then, late this summer, really under the threat that has now become reality, the Teamsters Union, which has the most employees at a Hostess, the Teamsters agreed to more givebacks that were being put into effect this month. But when they were put into effect and imposed on the Bakers Union against the Bakers Union's wishes, the Bakers Union went out on strike, which precipitated the company being liquidated. I mean, everybody sort of showed their hands. This was an exquisite game of chicken. Everybody was looking to see who would blink first, and the union called Hostess's bluff, and Hostess said, "We're shutting down."
What does the union gain by calling their bluff at this point?
Well, I mean, that's the right question. I think there are two answers. First, lots of folks act out of emotion rather than rationality, so you could conclude that the Bakers Union ultimately acted against self-interest and behaved out of pique. They finally said, "We've had enough of how we've been treated by Hostess, and that's it. And if that means that our 6,000 or 7,000 employees will be temporarily out of work, even in a bad economy, so be it." I think that's partially true, but I also think the Bakers Union conceivably could have been making what they see as a rational decision, that some of Hostess's brands, like Twinkies or Wonder Bread, will ultimately be sold to other bakeries, which will need bakers and which will need Teamsters drivers, and that those former Hostess employees will get jobs. That's a pretty dicey calculation because there's a lot of overcapacity in the industry, and it's possible that another bakery which bought Twinkies products, bought Twinkies intellectual property, could make them and deliver them without hiring any employees from Hostess. So to the extent the Baker's Union was making what they viewed as a rational calculation, they may be dead wrong.
Or a unionized workforce in any case.
Well, that's right, but I don't discount the role of emotion. And the unions gave back a lot in 2009, and they were giving back even more this time. At some point, everybody gets angry, however irrational that might seem.
Well, David Kaplan, the union put out a statement last Friday. Our members were aware that while the company was descending into bankruptcy and demanding deep concessions, the top 10 executives of the company were rewarding themselves with lavish compensation increases, with the then CEO receiving a 300% increase. I mean, did the union look and see a venal management and say, we want these guys out no matter what?
I mean, unions have been known to see venality in management since, you know, since forever ago, just as management often wants to blame unions. And you see finger-pointing going on here as well. There were missteps. God knows there were missteps in the Hostess management suite. And during this bankruptcy, the former CEO, who essentially was pushed out in the springtime, received a lavish increase. But the notion that executives being overpaid was the cause of the company's problems is ridiculous. It may be emblematic of management overreach, but this company's problems go way, way back, and they even predate the first bankruptcy. You know, Hostess was an amalgamation of many different bakeries. They were on an acquisition binge on and off for two decades, and trying to bring all of those products under one roof and deal with all these different and conflicting labor contracts is very difficult. When you combine that with the fact that a lot of Americans had ambivalent views about snack cakes and about their unwholesomeness, and then when you have a recession in 2009, all of those things conspire to jeopardize a company, and Hostess was victim to all of that.
Could there have been some way that they would not have ended up with this not funding the pensions and ended up with this huge pension liability? I mean, was there money to go into those pensions?
Was there money when? Now or
no,
several years ago?
Several years ago.
Well, the multi-employer pension plans that, according to management, were the root of the company's problems were certainly extraordinarily generous and perhaps anachronistic. There is a larger problem across the country in private and public pensions, where these plans are unfunded to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. Hostess isn't the first company facing it. Hostess and the unions had to come to grip with that underfunding. But again, the notion that this was the union's fault, I think, is misplaced, because the only way you get a pension plan is if both sides agree. The notion that the unions imposed it on management is wrong. Management had to agree to these sweet deals.
So does
now, was there a way to restructure the pensions to make the company viable? According to management, yes, and the Teamsters, one of the two big unions here, agreed. The problem is Hostess planners don't have a lot of credibility. Remember, they came out of bankruptcy in 2009 saying the company was viable, and here they were in a second bankruptcy. You know, bankruptcy is called Chapter 11. The old joke is this was a Chapter 22. And fool me once, what about fool me twice? So if you go back, knowing what you know now, if you go back and look at where the company was in 2009 as it came out of its first bankruptcy, you can easily conclude they didn't have a chance, as you could conclude that even if the Baker's Union here went along, that the company's long-term prospects were not particularly good.
All right, so just last real quick question. If the creditors start lining up, do the unions, as the company is liquidated, do the unions get some of that asset? Are they in line?
No, they're not. Now, they're unsecured creditors, but as with most bankruptcies, the unsecured creditors, as well as stockholders, get nothing. The hedge funds will primarily be the, which invested lots of money back in 2009, they'll get most of the crumbs, if you will.
All right, David Kaplan, I appreciate you giving us a little bit of that, most of the crumbs. I let that go by. I didn't hear it at first.
Yeah, that was my first one. It was very tempting through the whole process to use these puns, but that's the only one that I'll mention, although you could say that this whole melodrama sort of takes the cake.
David Kaplan is a contributing editor of Fortune magazine, 20-year career as a writer, editor for Newsweek. He teaches journalism at NYU. Last July, he started writing about Hostess. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
By the way, it affects us right here in the Northwest. As you know, the site of the Seattle bakery that Hostess brands closed Monday won't probably be abandoned for long. The one-acre South Lake Union property located on Dexter North Republican is valued at $7.8 million by the county assessor. It could be worth more. Across the street, there's a small Vulcan real estate property. It was reportedly worth between $10 and $12 million. This is Weekday.
Coming up next, Defending Nature with Sound. We'll talk with natural sound recordist Martin Stewart about the global plight of dolphins. Stay with us.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, offering complete holiday meals, sustainably raised meats, seasonal recipes, and more, with 9 neighborhood locations. More information at pccnaturalmarkets.com/holiday.
The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for many parts of western Washington through tomorrow afternoon. Right now, clouds, heavy rain in Seattle, 51 degrees in the U District. We're expecting clouds and showers the rest of today, the high in the low 50s. Cloudy, rainy, and windy tonight, the low in the upper 40s. Same for tomorrow, cloudy, rainy, windy, the high in the low 50s. It's 9:17.
This is Weekday, Defending Nature with Sound now. Nature sound recordist Martin Stewart wanted to give something back, and for him that meant fighting for the planet and her critters by doing some recording. It's good to see you again.
It's great to be here again, and thanks for having me. But also thank you for Katie Saw for pulling me in again.
Keeping track of you.
Yeah.
Where have you been of late?
I just spent 5 days in the UK at the International Whale Festival. I did a talk there about the plight of the dolphins in Taiji. Before that, I was back out in Taiji in Japan. For 30 days, documenting the killing and the slaughtering.
All right, well, let's talk about that. You did this documentary. It was Dawn to Death, the Dolphins of Taiji. I'll tell you what, to set up this, we have a few clips from this, but before we play them, who are these dolphins and why are they being slaughtered?
Well, the dolphins are on a migratory path that every year between September and March, there's a migratory path that various species of dolphins take, and not very far out from the mainland. Taiji, being this one place in particular, is on the southeast of Japan. And so there are bottlenose, risos, dolphins, Pacific striped, pilot whales, a number of other species that pass there.
A pretty rich sea right there in terms of wildlife?
Once
or depleted?
I must suppose.
So depleted already?
It's depleted already,
yes. Right.
So there are basically 27 fishermen in this community in Taiji that use high-powered boats to go out and capture them with sound.
With sound? They use the sound of their boats to...
They use poles. They drop the poles into the water and then they basically hammer the end of the pole. And what this does is they create a formation in the boats, and it distorts the animal's sonar system. And so, confused and so on, they are directed to shore. And if you've ever seen the movie The Cove, you understand basically how that sort of works. And I recommend anybody to look at The Cove. It was made 4 years ago. won an Academy Award for the best documentary. And it was basically that film that inspired me to go off to Taiji and try and create some sort of awareness.
Well, we have two sounds here. Let's listen to this sound from this documentary, which is the banger boats driving the dolphins. Sounds almost benign, Mark Stewart. Sounds like just cables clicking on some mast.
Sounds like a construction site, doesn't it? But it's one of those real horrific sounds that you hear there and you can't get it out of your head. Nighttime when you sleep, you hear this banging forever. And witnessing it from afar, there's various watching points that we go out and observe them. And then you quickly know that they have a pod of dolphins to drive in, and you see this confusion and leaping out of the water and trying to get away from it. You know, it's like being in a room with a baby screaming, I suppose, for us, and we're trying to find some solitude.
What are they doing with those dolphins? What's their market?
Well, that's the worst. That's the worst point. Once they get them to land, they drive them, they corral them into this tiny killing area that was exposed by, as I say, the film The Cove. And they're allowed 2,000. I must say they're allowed 2,000 per year, as their permits allows. 8% of those 2,000 go into captivity, a life of slavery, places like dolphinariums, places like SeaWorld, for our entertainment. And then the rest are slaughtered and sold for meat.
Who eats the meat? Because I don't see too much dolphin meat on sale out here.
You don't see dolphin meat basically on sale in Europe or America. And you don't really see dolphin for sale in Japan. They'll label it as whale meat. And they eat a lot of whale meat. But
that's funny. So whale is acceptable in Japan, but dolphin wouldn't be.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, I suppose dolphins are whales. They're small cetaceans. The International Whaling Commission allowed Japan to capture small cetaceans, so they wiped that off the list of protected species. And under the name of research, they're able to go and do that, but there's no research involved here. When they slaughter the animals, I've documented some of the worst brutality I think I've ever mustered up. And you see young babies swimming through their mother's blood as their family is just annihilated in front of them. And then sometimes as gestures, they'll take a baby out to sea and dump it out to let it go and fend for itself, which is just ludicrous.
All right, you have documented some gruesome sounds. Here's a little bit of sound from Martin Stewart's documentary, The Dolphin, Dawn to Death, The Dolphins of Taiji. So what are we listening to here?
This is a pod of 90 dolphins in the cove itself, and one by one they're being slaughtered. And these dolphins are communicating to each other. Basically, the language I don't understand, but I could imagine that it would be, see you later, basically, in death speech. I've had these sounds analysed by oceanographers and so on, and they've never experienced these kind of sounds before. If you look at the frequency on a sonogram, you'll see this kind of disorientation in the sound waves, as opposed to something that's a dolphin that's swimming freely.
The Academy Award-winning movie The Cove, about the ongoing slaughter of dolphins, inspired sound recordist Martin Stewart to act. The result is a mini-documentary called Dawn to Death, The Dolphins of Taiji. All right, first of all, yes, but things die and we eat them. Why do we always return to, dolphins get special preference other than tuna or...
Well,
or
they
other
don't,
fish that are slaughtered?
In my book, they don't get special preference because I don't eat any animals. I don't, you know, I don't eat what I record for a start. although I've recorded corn growing, so I suppose I've eaten corn. But I don't give them special preferences. And many often I'll go to Taiji and try to tell people there that I'll stand with you and stop this genocide that's in existence. But you come back and stand with me and we'll try and stop the slaughter of pigs and cows and chickens and so on. You know, we could change the way that we live totally. We could, this earth could feed us a lot better than what we take from it. We take too many resources from the planet. The oceans are being depleted. Japan uses the oceans as a garden because they say they can't grow what we basically grow. But, you know, this is silly to have small land. I mean, for instance, if you're eating a hamburger, you're taking 200 gallons of water to make that, you know, by feeding and fending for the animal itself. Whereas we've got 7 billion people on the planet, we can't sustain that kind of growth at the moment by taking all these resources that we pillage.
I asked you if you were excited for the holiday coming up. What was your response?
Well, it's ironic, isn't it, that you're going to be talking about turkeys in the next hour. 50 million of these beautiful animals are killed every year. You know, I don't like people throwing things down my throat, religion, so on, personal beliefs, but I think this is something that we need to look at in a totally different light. I have a grandkid of 4.5 years of age, and I want to be able to pass on the planet to him the way that I knew it when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. And we're losing species at a rapid rate. When I was 6 and 7, I remember going to a museum in the UK, and I was looking at the Irish elk, and it was extinct, and at the side of that was a picture of the dodo, and I didn't understand what extinction meant. And I looked it up in a book, and it's basically no more. You know, we can't go and buy that back from somewhere else. But now, we are losing species at an alarming rate, and we don't seem to connect to this.
When you were, where else have you been of late besides Taiji? Where else have you been?
Central, South America, Africa.
So how did they look? When was the last time you were in Africa, for example?
Africa, I was there last year. I went to Namibia, Mozambique.
When was the first time you were in those places? Or those the
first time I was there was probably 1981.
All right, so how do they look 20, 30 years later?
Terrible.
Worse. You can see the decline in animal species?
Oh, absolutely.
Or numbers?
Mozambique, for instance, have lost large areas of fish stocks in these natural reserves. And it's basically down to the Asian market that Chinese vessels will go in there and deep trawl nature reserves. We were in Africa last year, and we snuck onto a harbor in Maputo in Mozambique, and we put these transponders on these Chinese fishing vessels, and through Google Earth we were able to monitor where they were going.
What, did you sneak them onto the vessel?
We got into shark infested waters, and we stuck them on with magnets. And we went to the government to show them where these people were going. And, of course, the Chinese are bunging these government officials to turn a blind eye. But talking to various people, conservationists, the manta ray and various other rays around there, whereas 7, 8 years ago you couldn't see the ground, the bottom of the ocean for them, now it's very rare to see these rays. So infrastructure is being put in place by the Chinese, and all the resources are being taken out.
Infrastructure to extract the resources,
to extract
or extract
the resources? Yeah, through the forests, through poaching, through rhino horns, elephant tusks. In Zimbabwe,
what do they say? They're saying we're there to help the economy grow and raise these people out of poverty.
Well, the difficulty is how do you tell somebody you're not supposed to go and kill something if that's the only way they're making money? I mean, we have to help them. We have to make a conscious effort from the rich countries to help the poor countries. I don't, you know, Steve, I don't know the answer to all that stuff. I wish I did. I wish I had some divine literature that just opened up in front of me and I could give the word. But what I do know is that once we've lost the species, that's it.
Martin Stewart has naturesound.org, where he has been for many years recording the natural soundscape. And I guess once you start doing that, the politics of it or the reality of it hits pretty quickly, right?
Yes, it does. It's some of my most favorable time is when I'm out in nature recording. But even the soundscape has become extinct. 25 years ago, I could record a pristine hour. That's with no man-made noises or anything within 3 or 4 hours. I could get that 1 hour. And today it takes over 2,000 hours to obtain that 1 hour.
Even in the more remote places?
I was here a couple of 3 years ago talking about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And 60 miles out from Prudhoe Bay, I could hear the oil fields. Yeah, you know, in a day when the wind is in the right direction. So it's noise pollution. And my sound archive, I think if you downloaded my sounds to an iPod, it would play for 1,100 and something days.
37.5.
Well, there you go. You know,
I've got it right here.
All my research.
Well, it's just right in front of me here.
And 60 to 70% of that archive now is extinct.
The creatures or the soundscape?
No, the soundscape itself. Because a colleague of mine in California, a great friend, Bernie Krause.
Sure.
He had, or still has, a bed and breakfast down there in Sonoma. And he had a couple come for a week from New York. And the next morning, the bags were packed at the bottom of the stairs. And he said, "What's the problem? Is the bed not comfortable? Is the room not warm enough?" And he said, "No, it's just too quiet. We can't sleep." So he made a disc of trucks and bin lorries and so on like that so that they felt at home. So they played that disc all the way through the night and they stayed the next week.
Oh,
what
humanity, we've been changed.
We've become something crazy, I reckon.
All right, I want to play just a couple of songs, sounds here before you go because of the work you've been doing. So here's, what is this? This is a Hawaiian crow, which is an endangered species. Where did you record this?
Well, this was on the Big Island. These were the last two crows in existence. This is extinction at work here. And what I witnessed was the male bring the female a flower as if to say, you know, this is our last time together. And now the Hawaiian crow is extinct in Hawaii.
In the wild?
Mm.
Don't they? It still exists, right, in captivity?
They have, I believe, 20 now, 25 in a propagating area, but they're getting old. And when they release them, the other endangered species takes them out of the takes them out of the sky. So they're on a hiding to nothing. I recorded these birds in captivity, and I wasn't allowed to see the birds, and they feed them with puppets. But I cried my eyes out with these sounds because, you know, it's not like Ronald Reagan would say, once you see a redwood, you see them all. It may be a black bird, you know, boring, drab. But this bird had a place on the planet, and we took it away from them.
The Alala. What about these Cape Cross seals? Remember where you recorded them?
Yes, in Cape Cross.
In Namibia. I guess I made it easy for you.
Yeah, you did. In Namibia, we went out to Namibia to witness and document the slaughter of seal pups, which Namibia deny they do. And what they do is... They slaughter 90,000 pups per year in season. Every morning from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock. Then they clean the beaches up and then they let the public in to view their colony. So they make more money from people visiting the colony to see these beautiful animals, but they also make $7 a pelt for the fur industry.
What are they doing here? This is just the sound of the seals themselves.
Well, these seals, we were a few miles out, dressed up in ghillie suits and videoing them and watching them being corralled, separated from their mothers, and then clubbed to death, and then slid open, and you watch them regurgitate their mother's milk. And this is the reason they do this too. Namibia will say that they kill the slaughters, they cull the seals, because again they're eating the fish, and they don't say that Namibia increased their fish stocks from 200 tons to 400 tons in the 1 year.
They're fishing, the amount they harvested.
Yeah, the harvest. So again, you know, the animal gets the wrath. Have I depressed you?
No, that's fine. This is the job. Where are you going next, Martin Stewart?
I will be going back to Taiji in between my work. I'm doing a lot of editing at the moment for sounds, for documentaries and so on. But I'll be going back to Taiji again in March. And it's always been my kind of way of life now. I've dedicated my life for the animals because they've given me so much of my time.
Where do you make money? How do you support yourself?
Well, I work in film, documentary, TV. I do have a full-time job collecting sounds. And I want to be able to preserve these sounds and try and create awareness around the world, because I want to stop people going to dolphinariums. I want to stop people from abusing the planet, hopefully. Or I'd like to ask people to stop doing it. I don't think, you know, there's a bit of hypocrisy with me included. The dairy industry is something awful, but I'm not vegan. I'm vegetarian and I drink milk. And maybe now after admitting this, later on I'll stop doing it because I could get jabbed about it. But I don't want to preach to people about what's happening for sure, but I want to create awareness. So Taiji, I'll be going back to Taiji, and I will be documenting again the awful brutality that's going on there.
You know, we have links at our website to Dawn to Death, the Dolphins of Taiji, and also NatureSound, naturesound.org, Martin Stewart's website. Resting Cheetah, we're going to listen to Resting Cheetah. Set that sound up for me.
That sound was recorded in Port Elizabeth in South Africa. And I ran a 300-foot cable in the night while I sat in the car. And I heard this sound. And, of course, I wasn't going to go out and have a look and identify it. But the microphones were set under an acacia tree. And in the morning when I went to retrieve the microphones, there was nothing left there but a pile of bones. So, obviously, this animal had had its lunch or its dinner or its tea. And rested up, and I got this amazing sound of it purring away.
You know, we've been doing sounds of the day. People have been sending us sounds inspired by you and others. Maybe we'll play some of the bird songs of the Puget Sound in Washington
State.
That'd
be wonderful.
This lovely CD that you gave me. All right, Martin Stewart, I hope we talk again.
I hope so, too.
And I, you know, that's the job.
And take a look at the turkey you're about to eat on Thursday and think about the tofurkey option.
All right, I will keep your thoughts in mind.
Thank you.
Martin Stewart is a natural sound recordist. He works in film, TV, and radio as well. This is Weekday.
It's 9:39. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Coming up, Como's Brian Johnson reflects on his 58-year career in radio and TV. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting Wagner's four-opera Ring Cycle in August 2013. Full cycle tickets available starting November 12th at seattlering.org.
On the next Radiolab.
If you tell me the average speed of walking in some city X...
And only the walking speed?
That's right. I can tell you how much crime there is in the city, the average wage, number of theaters, number of colleges, the population, and the number of AIDS cases it's going to have this year.
Taking the pulse of a city. That's on the next Radiolab. Join us.
And that comes your way Friday night at 7 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Regents Blue Shield. Regents, your health, connected. Regents Blue Shield serves select counties in the state of Washington and is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Clouds and heavy rain in Seattle, 51 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the high in the low 50s, cloudy, rainy, and windy tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low in the upper 40s, tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
All right, now we turn to Brian Johnson, 58-year veteran of radio and television in Washington State. He began his career as an engineer, radio station KAPA in Raymond. Wow, in 1955. Is that station still around?
January of 1955. Makes me sound even older.
Wow. Started at Como Radio in October 1959, news director in 62, joined Como 4 News in 1976, and then you retired.
I did, but I'm getting old.
I don't know.
After 58 years in the business, you know, that's enough to get you old.
So here, I was watching various tributes to you and interviews, but I am going to start with something a little more mundane, maybe, or not, if I may. You have covered every mayor since 59.
Mm-hmm.
You have seen the city change.
A lot.
So let's talk about those changes. And let me start with a question I have. You said that if you wanted to do anything in the 50s in Seattle, you had to go to Portland.
That's correct. Seattle was sort of a dead little city. I used to live in Centralia because I worked at KELA. I had a choice. It was about equidistant. I could drive to Portland or I could drive to Seattle. The only reason I drove to Seattle was my mother lived in Tacoma.
All right, but Seattle had some. They winked at gambling. They winked at prostitution. I imagine too.
Oh yeah, but you could drive to Aberdeen and get prostitution. You could drive to Aberdeen and get gambling, and that wasn't as far from Centralia where I was working.
Was there corruption in the Seattle?
Oh yes. Oh yeah.
But homegrown. Was it mob corruption or was it just your typical homegrown kind of?
Everybody likes to believe it was homegrown. I have seen no evidence that it was not. I mean, some people will argue about George Cavano and Dave Beck in the Teamsters Union.
Right.
But if you're talking about typical crime, payoffs, police, that was all homegrown. And it started because we had some of the strictest blue laws that were passed in 1909, Steve. You're probably too young to remember.
No,
I
remember.
One of the big
that.
Controversies in Seattle in the mid-50s was whether or not church bingo was legal.
Really?
Church bingo.
Well, I can see the corrupting factors.
And so that everything virtually was illegal. You had the Ben Paris and the Turf in downtown Seattle, which were your gambling meccas. But there were lots of other places that had games going. And the police took payoffs to let it go.
So did it affect the police's ability to do their regular job, this sort of low-level corruption you're talking about?
It allowed crime to flourish. Did it stop them from investigating home burglaries, murders? No. Most of the
why
stuff
do you say
was,
it a lot?
I'm going to look the other way, and you're going to pay me to look the other way. And then I'm going to give a third of what I make to my lieutenant. And the lieutenants are going to make a third of what they get available to the captains. And the captains are going to pay the assistant chiefs. In 1971, we had 19 police officers indicted. More of them took the Fifth Amendment before the federal grand jury or before the local grand jury. All of that was thrown out.
How come?
It was thrown out because of a very, very good attorney by the name of Basil Baddeley. And Basil argued before the Washington State Supreme Court that the provisions of our state's constitution required any sworn public officer to tell the truth when he was called before a jury. Byron argued to the Supreme Court that that was an implied grant of immunity. The Supreme Court bought it. They threw out all the indictments, and they also threw out the indictments of the three members of the Liquor Control Board who allegedly were taking payments from distilleries to put certain booze in the state liquor stores.
Wow. Wow.
And all the reports that were written by the local grand jury were sealed forever. They still have not been released.
Oh, really?
41 years later.
You can't, how can you seal something forever? I thought we had a law against that.
Well, the Supreme Court said the report of that grand jury is based on an illegal indictment. It is therefore ordered sealed. It may be in the vaults somewhere. I would love to read it.
Oh, yeah.
In it lies a book.
Oh, yeah. All right. So, Brian Johnson, when did it change? When did the police department change? And when did Seattle take itself more seriously?
Seattle started taking itself more seriously when Gracie Hansen opened a nudie review on the gay way of the World's Fair.
Oh, really? That's when it said, oh, we got to look around what we're doing?
Well, she had run one in Portland before. And then she came up to the World's Fair here. And all of a sudden, we had people coming to this town. And I think the Chamber of Commerce and everybody else realized, hey, there's money in tourism. There's money in being a bigger city. And we started becoming a bigger city in 1962. It took a while, but we started then.
And is that also when, for example, people expected the police not to be as corrupt?
No.
It took another 20
that
years?
See, the indictments were not until 1971 as a result of pretty good work by a radio reporter by the name of Ron Henson, who worked for Cairo at that time, and by reporters for the Times and PI who were both looking into it. When those indictments came down, Wes Allman was mayor. And he fired Frank Moore just for going before a federal grand jury and taking the Fifth Amendment. He said, I can't have a police chief who does things like that. And Wes sort of led the drive to clean up the city. And it took in 1971. Now, that doesn't mean that everything was hunky-dory, just ask the Justice Department. But it does mean that the police started paying attention to all the laws rather than the laws they were not paid to look the other way on.
So this is what I thought. When all the things I read about you said, you know, Brian Johnson, he's the smartest guy in the room. It must be in part because you remember a lot of stuff.
I remember a lot of stuff, but I don't know if I'm the smartest guy in the room.
Well, you are in this room. But, I mean, you remember a lot, and you have this historical memory. What are you going to do? I mean, being retired from the day-to-day, that doesn't retire. You're going to write?
No. I think on Como, it doesn't mean my brain's in retirement. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. You know, it's only been a week.
Yeah, I know.
Steve.
Let's hurry up.
You don't think of what you're going to do the rest of your life in the first week that you don't have something to do. I did tell Holly Gaunt, who's the news director at Como, that I would be available, you know, on a freelance basis. But I don't want to go up and cover snow at the pass.
They're going to, yeah.
Or flooding on the streets,
yeah,
like today.
You would like, perhaps, to cover the news the way, and now I am asking if you're nostalgic or it happened that way, then the way the news was covered. Well, I guess back when Ron Henson was covering politics and had time to really go into it.
Yeah, there has been a change. And the thing that scares me more than anything else is social media. Social media is just wonderful if there is a riot, if there is an earthquake, if there is a tsunami. It helps people stay in touch. It can really hurt you. And it can hurt me from my standpoint of journalism, because if people just start talking to the people that they agree with, what happens to that inquiring mind that used to look left and right and center?
All right. Here, I heard you say something similar to this with Enrique Serna, too. But here's my question about that. When did, and I'm You know, you ask politicians hard questions. So it's, when did TV news decide that it was more important? Maybe not when. Why did TV news decide it was more important to focus on a break-in, a car chase, a murder, to the, let's face it, covering government, covering city politics, that comes third, fourth on the newscast. Why?
It may have started with KGO, which was a San Francisco television station, which at one time stood for Kickers, Guts, and Orgasm. And as a result of changing its philosophy to that, they grabbed something like 60% of the television audience in San Francisco.
Whoa.
And people started looking at that, and that sort of led to the if it bleeds, it leads philosophy. I think there are still stations that try to stay above it. But you can't not lead with it if everybody else is leading with it, because we have encouraged people to think that way.
Well, you made the joke about not wanting to cover the storm at the pass. But we as viewers, we seem to want – do we want that? Do we need that? Or are we being fed that?
It's a good question, because I think that what you're playing to right now are the people who still turn on the television at 5 o'clock. The people who still turn on the television at 6 or 6:30.
Big audience still, right?
It's a big audience, but it is not the audience it used to be. It does not reach all the way across socioeconomic lines now. People may be watching more C-SPAN. They may be watching more CNN. Some of the truly devoted news listeners have found other niches in which they now fit. Heck, they may even be listening to KUOW.
I actually heard you cite KUOW because we have – we have Olympia reporter. We have a Salem reporter. We have a Pullman reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Pullman is not being a state capital, but we have these we have these places where we're trying to do beats.
Yeah, and we used to have beats like City Hall and County Courthouse. But it is very, very difficult, as every reporter here knows, to make that interesting, particularly if you're talking about an audience that is not the type that is turning on to get that type of stuff. And your position on our dial encourages people to come here and get that. I mean, it's your reputation. It's what you bank on.
What's important now in terms of covering? Let's stick with City Hall for right now. Whenever I talk to people about what's going to happen in City Hall in the in this election year, many people say, oh, yeah, McGinn, they're discounting him. He's going to lose because he's going to have so many challenges in the primary. So as a reporter,
he's going to lose to somebody from the city council.
That's what they're arguing.
Yeah, I mean, that's like
you're arguing
the governor lose to somebody from the legislature.
Yeah, but he's going to lose is their point. What's important to look at right now in city politics in Seattle?
Look at how much it has changed. I mean, obviously McGinn's going to run not on bicycles. He's going to run on what's happening at South Lake Union. He's going to run on a successful effort to get the people to approve money for the seawall. He's going to try and forget all about the Alaska Way Viaduct.
But he's talking about that stadium.
Yeah. And he's – if Chris Hansen winds up with a team here and everything turns around and is wonderful and people fall in love with Vancouver South, which is Lake Union – Then he could even be reelected. And he has trimmed up a little bit. His beard looks a little neater. His presence is a little more mayoral than it was in the past. And the others, it's hard to run from the city council. I mean, do you think people really know who Tim Burgess is? Or Richard Conlon? Or if Peter Steinbrück comes back, who's he?
Ed Murray.
Yeah, Ed Murray, people know.
Because he's a little bigger stage,
yeah.
Huh?
He's got a bigger stage, and he's had a heck of a stage with 74 and with the efforts in the legislature.
Well, what's the uncomfortable question that each of these people need to hear? You're not going to be here, so somebody's going to have to ask the uncomfortable question.
I may be here. I mean, I'm...
All right. Well, we're calling you up. We're calling you up for the uncomfortable question, then. What's the uncomfortable question that somebody like Burgess or McGinn or Ed Murray needs to be asked right now?
I think they all need to take a look at which way is Seattle? You know, number one, are we going to be Vancouver South, or do we pay attention to people who've lived here forever? Is the entire mood of Seattle to bring in the young entrepreneur and put them up in a $700,000 downtown condo? Is that what the people of Seattle really want? Then if you go into the neighborhoods, some of the neighborhoods are going to be threatened with multifamily development. I can't see Queen Anne remaining Queen Anne. There are going to be questions raised about that. More importantly, however, is the budget of the city of Seattle is in as much trouble as the state budget. Not right now, but 2, 3, 4 years out. So what are we going to do? Are we going to try, what additional taxes does the mayor want? What programs would they be willing to sacrifice? Can Seattle really align itself with its school system even farther? You know, the education levy that McGinn and others have championed, can Seattle afford that, or is it going to have to start pulling that money back in just to run city programs? Well, running a city ain't cheap.
Well, the governor says he's just going to grow jobs. That's how we'll do that.
Yeah, I know the governor says he's just going to grow jobs, but Governor Gregoire has been warning both of them from the start of the campaign that balancing the state budget will take a tax increase, and Jay Inslee probably deep down knows it, only he'd rather have Ed Murray or somebody else push it.
Oh, is that how you think it's going to? I mean, because something's going to have to come out.
Something's going to have to come out. The legislature is going to have to say, hey, look, we can't balance the budget this way. Or Gregoire will submit one more budget. The legislature could run with that. Inslee's got a biennium to get things going.
What, you think they would let him? Do you think he would let them do that? Pass a budget that has a tax increase, as this governor who said, and one more Democratic governor,
two-thirds vote. Yeah. So I'm not sure. It's not going to be a tax increase as such. But what are you going to do with parks, for example, Steve? That parking pass doesn't work. The state park department is in deep, deep trouble. It's going to need a revenue source.
Our job as media people are to remind people to buy the pass, maybe. See, you're not going to miss this, right? Because you'll still be doing it. I can tell you're still going to be doing this.
I don't know what I'm going to be doing. It's only been a week.
All right. We're calling you up again for asking more questions. Okay. Brian Johnson, 58-year veteran of radio and television. You are steeped in the knowledge of the region, so we have to pry that out of you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate your work. I appreciate coming and talking to us. This is Weekday on KUOW.
Okay.
And now, the sound of the day.
He's working it. That's 8-year-old Simon practicing the piano. His grandmother, Liz, took a video of him, sent us a copy so we could all appreciate Simon's hard work. Recording a little video is a fine way to capture the sounds of your life. Share them with us. We want the sounds of your day. Be on our sound of the day. So you head into the holiday week, record some interesting sound you're hearing. Email it, sound of the day in the subject line, weekday@kuow.org, and tell us a little bit about the life you're living that's coming out with this sound. We're going to talk a little bit about what's happening in Turkey land. And yes, we'll do that with Martin Stewart's codicil in mind. We're also going to talk a little bit more about the Dust Bowl with Tim Egan and some politics as well. A lot more coming up next hour on Weekday. Stay with us.
Stick around for NPR News in less than 2 minutes. Good morning. It's a minute before 10. I'm Andy Hurst.
In the new movie, Silver Linings Playbook, a family is obsessed with the Philadelphia Eagles. Kind of, says star Bradley Cooper, like his own family.
Our Sundays revolved around what time the game started. Whenever we were eating, we would bring the TV from the living room into the kitchen.
The sexiest man alive talks football and family on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That story and much more tomorrow morning from 5 until 9 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.